Warning number 0851185, United States v. Kivido, Ms. Fuentes.
Good morning, Your Honors. Carolyn Fuentes for Anthony Kivido. May it please the Court, Mr. Kivido challenges the constitutionality of his conviction under the Sex Offender Reporting and Notification Act, commonly known as SORNA. This statute punishes a failure to register or update a registration as a sex offender when a person changes residences or employment or his name or his status as a student. It has two jurisdictional predicates, two separate jurisdictional predicates. A prior conviction for a federal sex offense makes one liable for a failure to register. Crossing state lines and a subsequent failure to register by a person who has either a federal or state sex offender conviction will also confer jurisdiction. Neither of these predicates provided federal jurisdiction to convict Mr. Kivido for his local failure to register when he left El Paso in 2007 to return to his home in San Antonio that same year. The first predicate fails here because federal jurisdiction may not constitutionally be exercised simply by virtue of a prior federal conviction. Now, there was federal jurisdiction to prosecute Mr. Kivido in 1999 because he was in the Air Force and he had sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend. There was clearly jurisdiction for that. There was jurisdiction to punish him, and he got a 3-month sentence and a bad conduct discharge as his punishment. But once that 3-month sentence expired, the federal jurisdiction did as well. To reassert federal jurisdiction over Mr. Kivido's conduct, now many years later, the government relies on the federal custodial power that was discussed in the recent Supreme Court case of United States versus Comstock. The argument, I believe, is that the federal government's role as Mr. Kivido's custodian while he served his 3-month court-martial sentence permits the federal government now, nearly a decade later, to regulate his conduct by subjecting him to SORNA's provisions. And I think part of the rationale is that sex offender registration requirements are like probation or supervised release. They impose conditions on conduct after a term of incarceration is complete. But there are very important differences. Probation is a sentence imposed to punish an offense. And supervised release is also imposed as part of the sentence for the original federal offense. They are imposed at the time the federal government had proper jurisdiction of the offender. Now, once a federal offender has satisfied his sentence, he returns to the authority of the state, and the federal government no longer has an appropriate role. It's not like once someone commits a federal offense, they're a citizen of the federal government. Once they've satisfied their sentence, they return to the authority of the state, which has the residual power to govern the conduct of its citizens as well as provide for the safety of its citizens. And in fact, that position that once an offender completes his sentence, satisfies it, there's no more federal role, that was a position taken by the Solicitor General in Comstock. The Solicitor General conceded that the federal government lacks custodial power to exert federal control over an offender who has been released from prison and whose term of supervised release is also completed. And that is because, as I intimated before, once a federal sentence is satisfied, a transfer to state responsibility and state authority has occurred. At that point, the state police power over an individual has been fully reestablished. And the federal government may not simply reassert some new federal jurisdiction simply by virtue of that prior conviction. To do so, I think, is not necessary or proper to the exercise of the federal government's power over the military, which is ultimately the initial power which led to federal jurisdiction in Mr. Kivido's case. It was necessary and proper for the government to punish his sex offense because they have the power under the Constitution to make rules and regulations for the governance of the land and naval forces. And it was proper, necessary and proper to punish that offense because really, there's no teeth to the rule without it. Military members have to know if they break the rules, they are going to be punished. But once the punishment is satisfied, and certainly after the military member severs his relationship with the armed forces, the continued regulation of his conduct is not appropriate or plainly adapted to the exercise of Congress's power to make rules for the governance of the land and naval forces. And that the exertion of that power isn't proper either. It's not necessary and it's not proper because it invades state sovereignty, the state which is reasserted, which has its authority over the individual citizen. There is no jurisdiction under the second predicate because Mr. Kebido did not travel interstate and then failed to register. His crime was purely local. He moved from El Paso to San Antonio and failed to update his registration. Now, the government argues that the Commerce Clause permits the federal prosecution of Mr. Kebido by building on this court's holding in United States versus Whaley, which held that SORNA's provisions punishing those who use the channels of interstate commerce are constitutional. Because the punishment under that provision is valid, the court also found that registration requirements in 42 United States Code Section 16913 were valid as a means of furthering the goal of preventing offenders from slipping through the cracks by changing jurisdictions. The next step in the government's argument is that if registration provisions are valid, then it is also valid to permit punishment of those who fail to register, even if they don't cross state lines. But I think what that argument fails to acknowledge is that Congress may punish a failure to register only if state lines are crossed or some other jurisdictional hook applies. The federal conviction jurisdictional hook cannot be used because it is unconstitutional. It goes beyond the federal government's power. And the only jurisdictional hook that is left is interstate travel. And Mr. Kebido did not travel interstate. The government's argument, I think, results in a very broad Commerce Clause theory that would permit Congress to enact a general law requiring sex offenders to register simply because the public safety requires it. Such a law fails to conform to the overarching limitations that apply to the exercise of congressional power under the Commerce Clause. And those two powers are there has to be some line absolutely between what is truly national and what is truly local, and the federal government cannot invade the state, cannot take over the state police power. That has to be left to the state. I thank the court for an opportunity to make an uninterrupted statement, and I'm happy to take questions.
Ms. Fuentes,
yes.
Does your argument apply, your jurisdictional argument, does it apply equally after the effective date? Same circumstances, but after the effective date of the statute?
No, and it might, no, I don't think it does. After the effective date of the statute, people who become federal offenders will have been sentenced. People who will come into federal jurisdiction, since they're under federal jurisdiction,
they always have this problem with the statute over their heads.
Correct.
Okay.
And in addition, I'd say even, and I don't think the answer is completely clear, but I would say even for those offenders who were convicted, whose offense occurred before enactment of the statute, if they were still on supervised release, or some way under the authority of the federal government, there would be a stronger argument in the government's favor.
Okay. The only other question that I have is, am I correct? You're not suggesting that the statute is unconstitutional, but it is unconstitutional as applied to your client under these circumstances?
Correct. It is, in fact, a very narrow argument. And that very narrow argument, I think, makes it different from United States versus George, the Ninth Circuit case that ruled that the federal offender jurisdictional hook is legitimate and constitutional. Because although I will say it doesn't appear that the court relied on the fact that Mr. George was on federal supervised release, but he was, in fact, on federal supervised release. So I think that's a distinction and an important one.
Counsel, you may have answered this question, but as it relates to I think that was part of his question. I'm just trying to understand. As it relates to people that are in the military that commit sex offenses subsequent to SORNA, which I know is not this case.
Yes.
But subsequent to SORNA, why wouldn't that Congress's action be such that we wouldn't judge it? We'd just say they've decided that that was necessary and proper, and these people have to register even after they're out of the military, even after they're off of parole, because that's Congress said it was necessary and proper and set up before, you know, afterwards. This wouldn't touch that, would it?
I don't think so. And I think it wouldn't touch that because of the rationale in Comstock.
That's right.
Comstock says if the federal government has custodial control over you, and I might even go
We have a confluence here.
Yes.
Where the conviction occurred before SORNA. He came off all the restrictions from his conviction as it existed, and he left the service.
Yes.
And it's the confluence of all those things that you're saying in this particular case is all we have to answer.
That's correct.
And if we did that, we wouldn't have to, it wouldn't necessarily conflict with any of our Fifth Circuit holdings?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it would not conflict. Mm-hmm. There has not been a Fifth Circuit holding on the federal power and that on that jurisdictional hook. There has been Fifth Circuit authority on the interstate commerce jurisdictional hook.
There's also been a holding in the same case, Whaley, that Section 16913, the registration provision, is constitutional, although it does not have, it applies to intrastate activity and does not have an interstate hook to it individually. But we said that because SORNA is a comprehensive statute that and all of its provisions operate to make the whole thing work, that it would be undercut if you singled out one provision and say that's standalone has got to be constitutional as a standalone proposition. We have clearly said in Whaley they all work together. And seven or eight or nine other circuits have said the same thing.
I agree. So,
and why doesn't that also apply to this provision that requires federal offenders to register every time they move, even within a state? I can see that the court in Carr said that these provisions are not standalone. They're all based on the Commerce Clause.
Isn't the problem with what Judge Dennis is saying is that the conviction here does not rely on the Interstate Commerce Clause to any extent, and that this conviction is not under the Interstate Commerce Clause, but is under the Military Clause of the Constitution. And you have to demonstrate that it is necessary and proper to the enforcement of that particular clause and not the Interstate Commerce Clause, because the Interstate Commerce Clause has nothing to do with the underlying conviction. And the arguments that it may be necessary for the Interstate Commerce Clause has nothing to do with whether it is necessary and proper is directly related to the enumerated power upon which this conviction stands.
I agree, Your Honor. And I think that distinction is made very clear just by looking at the indictment. The indictment doesn't allege the crossing of interstate lines. But I also agree with
my... Let me try to clarify my question.
Okay.
The argument is that SORNA is basically designed, and I think there's congressional history to back this up and all kind of authority, it's basically designed to prevent sex offenders from slipping from one state to another. And as the Fourth Circuit said, in order to police that, you've got to know where the person starts out. And you got to know, you know, where he, each time he moves, you got to check to be sure he registers again. So the provision that says that the federal government is going to oversee what happens to federal prisoners inside states and says they must re-register every time they move makes sense to support that whole effort to prevent any sex offenders from going across state lines and eluding their registration requirements. So if there's nobody looking at the federal offenders in a state, they could move. You could have a guy here in New Orleans. He's a sex offender. He moves up to Rayville, Louisiana, and stays there 5 or 10 years. He's got a clean record there. Then he moves to Oklahoma, and everything that's checked back on him in Rayville comes out A-OK. That's what this whole scheme is designed to prevent.
Let me ask you, does anything, you're applied?
The channels of interstate commerce.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I agree with much of what you've said about what the how the courts have characterized the interstate commerce power and its interaction with SORNA and requiring registration both before and after travel. But I think that all of the courts that have decided this issue, Whaley included, and Gould, and all of the other courts of appeals that have decided the Commerce Clause issue, have been very careful to cabin their approval based on the fact that Congress is saying you will only be punished if you cross state lines. And I want to say Whaley did this. If you look at the language in Whaley, you've alluded to the language in Whaley? Correct, absolutely correct. But there's additional language. In this court's view in Whaley, SORNA did not, and I'm quoting, require sex offender registration generally, but instead focused on the problem of sex offenders escaping the registration requirements through interstate travel. And the court further observed, and this to me is very important because the court's words were, perhaps most significantly, neither 16913 nor any other provision of SORNA creates a federal penalty for failing to register while remaining within a state. So that those two provisions are really knit together very tightly. And I think the other courts of appeals have held that, too.
This court have upheld 16913, the registration provision. That certainly regulates intrastate activity.
And we
upheld it.
And only
9 other courts have, too.
Only because it cannot be punished and it cannot be divorced from the interstate commerce requirement.
Well, my question is, what relevance do the points that Judge Dennis is making have to the as-applied challenge that you are making in this case? And if you would explain what relevance that has, I would appreciate it.
Well, I don't like to make the government's argument for it, but I think that what the government says, the reason the government believes that view is relevant, is they see a broader Commerce Clause power than has been approved by the courts in these SORNA cases. They see a general Commerce Clause power to regulate everyone who fails to register intrastate or whether or not they use the channels of interstate commerce. And I think that is the bottom line to their argument.
I have a question about the same question that Judge Garza had, and I want to explore that a little bit more.
Yes.
If you say that it's constitutional at the time that someone is convicted to make them register and then to impose a penalty if they don't register intrastate, you said that's okay under the necessary and proper clause?
I think so.
Tell me what difference it makes that's imposed at the time of conviction or sentencing as opposed to 5 years later. Under the necessary and proper clause, what difference does custody make?
Because I guess a way to think of it is with the link analysis that Comstock used. And I think Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Comstock really used this more. In looking at the necessary and proper clause, Justice Kennedy said, it's not the number of links from the power. It's the strength of the links. Is there a strong enough connection, not too attenuated, between the power where it begins and the assertion of federal jurisdiction that is made today? So when the federal government has proper jurisdiction over someone, I think it's not too attenuated. And again, I hesitate to answer it because that's not our case. But I don't think it's too attenuated to say we're going to subject you to these SORNA requirements. But that chain, it's not just that the links are weak. The link has been broken. When someone in Mr. Kibito's position.
What is the government's interest in tracking a former member of the military who's been convicted of a sex crime 15, 20 years after the conviction? He served his time. He's no longer subject to supervisory oversight. But they want to track him for the rest of his life when he moves intrastate. What's the government's interest in that circumstance?
I don't see a government's interest in
but
that circumstance.
But you said that it's constitutional.
Well, I think it may be constitutional.
I don't think we second-guess Congress into what it thinks is necessary and proper. If they have someone that's in the military and they want to subject him to additional sanction on the basis that he's in the military and they want the people in the military that they're going to commit a crime, they're going to go to jail, and they're also going to be registered. We may think that it's harsh, but I'm not too sure that the courts are in a position to tell Congress, well, you can't look at the people in the Navy and the Army and say that they're not going to be subjected to this.
My only question is, what is the difference between the timing? That's my only question.
I'm sorry.
We're just talking about a question of timing here. And why does that make a difference under the necessary and proper clause and do just as they did in Comstock? Everything else aside, ex post facto, due process, putting all that aside, what difference does it make under the necessary and proper clause, the difference in timing? That's what I want to focus on.
Because at the time, if they're imposing SORNA requirements at the time someone is sentenced, the federal government still has proper jurisdiction. And again, I hesitate to make this argument because it doesn't have to be decided for this case. And I say this only because I don't know that Mr. Kebido's case, in fact, I know that Mr. Kebido's case won't necessarily require the court to rule that far. I can certainly understand how there might not be a federal interest, but I can understand under Comstock how there might be. And that interest is the federal custodial power.
Okay, but I want to get back to your answer to Judge Garza was broader than this is a condition of your sentence. We're going to say you have to register for life. I understand that argument. But you said, hey, now, even if that's not in, if we had a federal offender convicted today and nowhere in the sentence or whatever does it say you have to register, nonetheless, because he's convicted after the statute, then he would be required to register and that'd be okay even absent interstate commerce. And that, to me, seems to be exactly the argument the government made in footnote 5 of its en banc brief, where it says there was a statute that predates the current iteration that would have made him register at the time he was convicted. And so, in a way, you're conceding that point. Is that your position?
Well, two questions. First, is it my position that the federal government may have authority over someone who is sentenced today, and that's made, SORNA is imposed on them today after they're convicted. I think that position is defensible under Comstock, although it's not the case here. Now, in terms of conceding that Mr. Kebido is covered simply because some federal regulation existed at the time that he was sentenced, I don't view it that way. At the time that he was sentenced, SORNA did not exist, and there
were
earlier.
But there was a precursor to it, the Wetterling Act, that applied at the time. That's got a similar hook and a similar provision. So are we really reaching out on him if that statute's in place? I mean, I'm just asking you to respond to the government's argument.
Well, I would say that it is not a similar provision under the Wetterling Act or the Lynchner Act. The requirements there subjected someone to federal jurisdiction, well, I wouldn't even say federal jurisdiction, to federal regulation if they lived in a state that was not minimally compliant with sex offender registration laws. And so it doesn't apply across the board to all federal offenders. And in fact, by 1999, when Mr. Kebido was sentenced, I'm not certain that it applied at all to him. That provision, Lynchner, Wetterling, was limited to that. And I see my time is up.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. All right, Ms. Parker.
Good morning. My name is Cam Barker, and I represent the United States. If I may begin by giving a summary of SORNA's provisions and defendants' challenges to it. I think that would help clarify some of the court's questions. The provisions of SORNA that are relevant here are found in Title 42 of the United States Code and Title 18 of the United States Code. Title 42 contains a registration provision that requires any sex offender to register and keep current a registration in the jurisdiction where he lives, works, or goes to school. Title 18 then contains the criminal sanctioning provision for violation of the Title 42 registration requirement in certain circumstances, and those circumstances are in paragraph A2 of Section 2220, and they are if the person is a sex offender by reason of a federal conviction or if the failure to register occurs after interstate travel. The defendant is a federal sex offender, and he was charged under the first of those criminal sanctioning provisions, if you will, that he was a federal sex offender who failed to register as required by SORNA. He challenges the constitutionality of his conviction, saying that Congress did not have authority under Article 1, Section 8 to regulate that conduct. And I don't think fairly considered this is a challenge just to the criminal penalty qua penalty. I don't think defendant would concede that Congress would have the power to enforce the very same conduct through, say, a civil fine or a civil action for injunctive relief. Defendant's dispute is with Congress's power to actually regulate the conduct in the circumstances of his case, federal sex offender without proof of interstate travel. That is an as-applied challenge to the Title 42 registration requirement, which applies more broadly than that, and this defendant is disputing Congress's power to enact that requirement as it applies to the circumstances here. I view that as a facial challenge to the criminal enforcement provision to Section 2250, A, subsection, paragraph 2. And so I think we have to think of them as one challenge to Congress's authority under Article 1, Section 8 to regulate this conduct. And we raise two independent defenses of Congress's authority to do that. These are alternative arguments, and if the court agrees with us on either one, defendant's conviction should be affirmed. The first argument is based on the federal nature of defendant's conviction. Here, it was a federal conviction arising under Congress's military clause power to regulate the armed forces, and under the necessary and proper clause, Congress has authority in regulating the armed forces to enact the sex offense of which this defendant was convicted. In other cases, a sex offense conviction may be federal by reason of an exercise of Congress's other enumerated powers, perhaps its power to regulate activity in a federal enclave. But nonetheless, the first argument, the first alternative argument, depends on the federal nature of the conviction and Congress's role in defining the offense and providing for its punishment and providing for the person's responsible return upon the service of any confinement portion of that punishment. The second alternative argument draws on the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause and does not turn on the federal nature of the conviction. And under that argument, we say that because Congress has the authority to regulate the use of the channels of interstate commerce by convicted sex offenders to evade and defeat state registration and monitoring, it also has the power to enact reasonable aids to that prohibition, and that requiring sex offenders to inform the officials of their last location in a state, and not just their first location in a state, is something that Congress could reasonably and rationally determine is a valid complement to its authority to prohibit the use of channels of interstate commerce for that injurious purpose. That argument does not depend on the federal nature of defendant's sex offense conviction and does not draw on the military clause. It does draw on the Commerce Clause, Lopez Category 1, as we say, use of the channels of commerce, and it draws on the Necessary and Proper Clause. The federal nature of defendant's conviction is relevant to that argument in one sense. It is not the grounding of the constitutional authority, but because the Title 42 registration requirement can be enforced through criminal sanctions only in certain circumstances, one of which is for federal offenders and the other of which is interstate travel, those limitations on the enforcement do show that the statute is narrower in practice, in substance. And that's something that the court can consider when assessing under the Necessary and Proper Clause whether Congress had authority to enact this regulation. However, as I say, that is simply a factor in the Necessary and Proper Clause inquiry under the Commerce Clause theory. So if I can then delve into both theories, and I invite the court's questions at any time now that I've done my introduction.
Let me give you a hypothetical, if I may. There is undoubtedly a substantial class of persons who have been convicted of driving while intoxicated on federal lands, military reservations, Indian reservations, or whatever. They have served their time, paid their fine, and completed their supervised release. Suppose that tomorrow Congress were to enact a statute that said that because we believe that driving while intoxicated endangers others, that any such person is required now to display on his or her automobile a decal or a sign saying that I'm a convicted DWI offender to protect the general public, and assume further that there's no requirement of interstate travel with the vehicle. In your view, could there's criminal penalties for failure to display the sign or the decal on the vehicle. In your view, could Congress constitutionally enact that statute in order to protect the public?
I think that's a slightly harder argument. It's possible. It's slightly harder in this case because I'm not aware of any findings or basis for findings that convicted DWI offenders pose the same frightening and high risk of recidivism that Congress found was present here with respect to federal sex offenders, nor is there any particular need for federal action in that area, so far as I'm aware, because of the nature of the background regulation system. So in contrast to your example, here all 50 states had sex offender registration systems, and the states could essentially grab sex offenders who were in jail as they were coming out because they're in state custody, but there is no federal system.
So what's the answer? Could Congress do it if it made the findings that there's danger to the public and that the danger is increased they could make statistical findings that recidivism in people who have been found guilty of DWI, and obviously a decal on the car would warn other drivers to be more careful. So the question is, under your argument, consistent with your argument here in the Kibito case, could Congress constitutionally enact that statute and impose criminal penalties for failure to comply?
I think perhaps if the findings were at the same level as in this case, but I'm not aware of any basis for such findings. In addition, the class of all DUI sex offenders is a broader class than the class of convicted sex offenders. The legislative findings here show that there are approximately 500,000 convicted sex offenders in the nation, of which only a handful of those will be federal sex offenders.
I'm sorry, what difference does that make? I mean, it seems to me if the class is larger, perhaps Congress would see a greater need. It seems to me that cuts against you if the class is larger.
One consideration the Supreme Court considered in Comstock was the scope or narrowness of the regulation. That's one consideration. There are others, the statute's accommodation of state interest, whether the statute is tailored to the specific end here, which is the federal government's role in confining and releasing these people. So I think that's one possible distinction. It's hard for me to speculate exactly about those facts, about your hypothetical, because we don't have the same long history of federal involvement and the same legislative findings that we do here.
What do you say about the as-applied challenge that everybody agrees that the SORNA is basically constitutional, enacted under the Commerce Clause and under the Necessary and Proper Clause supporting the commerce powers of the Constitution. But here, the conviction has no relation to the Interstate Commerce Clause. It has no relation to the necessary and proper authority under the Commerce Clause, but its conviction relies solely on the military clause. Now, what is your argument with respect to the fact that as to this individual under these circumstances, the law is applied unconstitutionally?
Well, I think your question could be asked of both of our two alternative theories. So let me first take the alternative theory that relies on the federal nature of the conviction. Here it's federal because of the military clause. There could be other reasons. As I understand defendant's position this morning, he's initially not disputing, or at least saying it may well be the case that for someone who is a federal offender today and offends and is convicted of, say, a military sex offense, and is then released from prison, that Congress, as part of its necessary and proper authority, could provide for a civil collateral consequence of that federal conviction, requiring that person to report his presence in the community for a certain period of time after his release because of the high risk of danger that these persons oppose in the federal government's unique – I'm sorry, Judge.
No, well, I mean, I don't – the reason I'm interrupting, I don't think you're answering or addressing the question, because here the individual was convicted under the military statute that applies solely to military crimes, and that the military loses all jurisdiction over this individual once you leave the military. It has no further interest in it. The military has no interest whatsoever in whether this man performs, violates the laws after he leaves. Now, the Congress does, of course, under the Interstate Commerce Clause, but this has nothing to do with the Interstate Commerce Clause and whenever you talk about an as-applied challenge. Why should this man, who has left the military and convicted only under military rules, be required to apply, be constitutionally required to register under a law that was passed under the Interstate Commerce Clause?
Let me come at that question from another angle, because we do agree that there is an Interstate Commerce Clause. I think the simplest answer for our Commerce Clause theory is that the movement between states that Congress determined was injurious and immoral was the movement by convicted sex offenders, regardless of the nature of their conviction, because state registration and monitoring systems apply to both sex offenders convicted in that state, convicted in other states, and convicted in federal court if they're resident in that state. So when sex offenders move in interstate commerce for the purpose of evading and avoiding registration, it matters not to that harm whether the sex offender is a sex offender under federal law, state law, territorial, tribal law, etc.
Then, so as I understand your argument then, the basis is that Congress can require every sex offender wherever convicted, under any circumstances, under state, federal, military law, or anywhere else, to register under SORTA.
That's part of the broader Commerce Clause argument. However, it's
important. I mean, that is part of your argument.
That's
your
part of our
argument,
broader,
and that is your response to my argument and to their argument, not my argument, but my point and their argument, that this is an as-applied challenge and should be limited as such.
Correct, yes. When defending against an as-applied challenge, it's certainly open to the government to defend a statute in all of its applications.
With respect to the first argument, the inherent nature of the federal conviction, to be clear, although Kevedo was convicted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, first off, is it correct, he is a convicted felon of what is essentially statutory rape and thus was a sex offender. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. Is there any diminution or differentiation in his convicted felon status as a sex offender because that offense occurred in the context of him being in the military as opposed to same felony offense had he been a civilian? In the sense of SORNA's requirements.
We're not making that argument specific to the military versus other federal powers argument here because the federal government's role in defining the federal offense, composing a sentence, and essentially having custody over the person for sentencing purposes is the same whether it's a military or other federal power.
Let me ask the question in a different way. I probably asked it in our ticket. I guess my point is to punctuate the conviction at issue here is a felony offense for what is in effect statutory rape.
I think if I said felony earlier, I think I should correct that. I think this offense was not a felony, or at least it was punishable by up to 6 months because of the nature of the court-martial in which he was convicted. But the offense itself is punishable by more than a year, even though in this proceeding it wasn't. Unclear whether it's a felony. It was a federal sex offense. And so that federal sex offense is the grounding of our narrower argument. And let me get back to the point I was making earlier, which is that I understand defendant to be essentially saying that it's relatively straightforward that Congress could have, for a military or other federal sex offender convicted today, could constitutionally have enacted Sorna's registration requirements going forward. But it's on the theory, essentially, that because those requirements were in place while he was in jail, they almost became part of the sentence. That might be a little loose analogy, but I think that's the basis of why defendant says that going forward, Congress could enact this requirement. So then the question becomes, could it have enacted it for persons who were released some time ago? And there's two responses to that. First is that there might be ex post facto clause issues with more comprehensive regulations, but there's no ex post facto clause issues with SORNA's simple reporting requirements under the uniform holdings of all the courts of appeals. The second is that Mr. Kebido himself did have a federal sex offender registration requirement enforceable by a federal criminal penalty on account of the federal nature of his conviction existing at the time he offended in 1999 and continuing through the enactment of SORNA. So even if
the court... But that goes to ex post facto. That doesn't go toward authority of Congress, does it? That's the separate consideration.
I agree with that, and I'm simply suggesting that if the court were to think otherwise and to think that it does matter to the Article I, Section 8 question, whether a particular sex offender had a federal registration requirement in place at the time of offense, sentencing, or release, those are also the facts of this case. But I do agree with your premise, Judge Benavidez, that timing question relates to the ex post facto clause.
Counsel, I'm concerned if you answer Judge Smith's question that it's possible if Congress made the necessary findings they could regulate these DWI federal offenders, why wouldn't it apply also for DWI state offenders under your second Commerce Clause argument, as I believe Judge Jolly was getting to earlier? What's the limit? If purely under the reasoning of your second argument, it would apply just as well to DWI state offenders who moved only in intrastate because they might one day go interstate.
No, our argument does not extend to...
Where does it stop?
It requires that narrower argument requires that the person's sex offense be a federal sex offense, which may be prosecuted only in federal courts, meaning that the federal government has a particular role and relationship with that offender by the federal nature of his conviction. And defendant says that may be if the registration requirement was imposed at the time of the sentencing.
Well, does the Commerce Clause require the federal nature, or is it this police power that comes in through the necessary? Where are you getting this that it has to be federal first?
There's two alternative arguments, and the federal nature is relevant to our argument that is something like the Comstock argument.
Right, but where does this Commerce Clause argument stop? You're bounding it by the federal nature, but the Commerce Clause is not dependent upon that. So why is that a proper boundary for that argument?
I think I'm either being unclear or you're misunderstanding, Judge Elrod. The two arguments are separate, and the Commerce Clause argument is not bounded.
That's what I'm saying. Then what bounds the Commerce Clause argument? What would keep it from applying to purely state DWI?
I think I understand your question. The reason the Commerce Clause argument allows Congress to enact a regulation requiring this narrow category of sex offenders to register is that Congress has a valid interest in prohibiting the interstate movement of sex offenders to evade and defeat this registration.
Right. But under the hypothetical Judge Smith posed, Congress had a valid interest in regulating the movement of DWI offenders. And so assuming that all those findings are made, that they're likely to be recidivist, et cetera, then why wouldn't it apply to purely state DWI traffickers if it's bounded by the Commerce Clause, not by the necessary problem?
I understood Judge Smith's hypothetical, and please correct me if I'm wrong, to relate to a federally convicted DWI offender and say, is there any possible world in which Congress could make findings?
Exactly. That's exactly what his hypo was. And you deferred to the prong one argument, but I'm asking you under your prong two argument, what bounds it so it would be limited in that context?
I think we're just having a miscommunication. I'm sorry. Let me try to come about this from another angle. We're relying on two independent sources of constitutional authority for this regulation. The first source relies on the federal nature of the sex offense, and so it wouldn't cover state sex offenders or DWI.
Right, that's the independent, but the second one could, and I'm asking you, what are the limits to that commerce power in this context?
Correct. So then moving to the Commerce Clause argument, we're saying that Congress, under a long line of authority, going back to Caminiti and Hoke, which concerned the Mann Act, has authority to prohibit the harmful use of interstate travel by people like sex offenders for immoral purposes, and that the harmful use of interstate travel to evade state registration and monitoring occurs regardless of whether the person's conviction is federal or state. So that theory applies equally to federal and state sex offenders.
I don't think the defendant is challenging that if he had moved interstate, he could have been indicted under subsection B.
I actually didn't hear the very beginning of your question.
That's not the case before us, and that's not the argument that's being made.
Okay.
This is not an interstate case. This is intrastate.
The movement here was intrastate, correct, and we did not charge Mr. Kebido under subparagraph A to B, which applies to interstate travel.
I have two questions, please. I'm sorry, Judge Jones.
That's all right.
First of all, I don't know why the federal government prosecuted this man unless it was part of a sweep to pick up sex offenders. Why didn't you just let the state do it? And the reason I say that is because some of these pleadings actually have other people's names in them that the government filed in the Kibito case. Could you let me know what's going on there? That's my first question.
I'm afraid I can't speak beyond the record as to why they prosecuted.
He would have been prosecutable under the state requirement that he just had intrastate travel. So I don't know why the federal government came in this kind of a situation.
I'm afraid I can't speak to the reasons for the prosecution. I think it probably because of the federal nature of his sex offense, the federal government wanted to enforce the requirement premised on that under A2A.
My second question is, why aren't you, the Department of Justice, bound by what now Justice, then Solicitor General Kagan said in the Comstock case? Why are you prosecuting this case? It seems like that was a concession, at least, or perhaps a judicial admission by an officer of the court representing the government. I don't see how you can avoid that.
Well, let me disagree with my colleague that was a concession about the entire police power. I've read the quote, and I recognize that the word police power was used. I think in context, it's clear that that's not what was being discussed. What was being discussed was the civil confinement power at issue in Comstock. The briefs make that distinction, and moreover, that's
after
how the
police and after completion of supervisory interest, that there was no supervisory interest on behalf of the government after someone was already released.
For the civil commitment power. And that's how the Supreme Court understood Solicitor General Kagan's concession in Comstock. Its opinion talks about the power to civilly commit someone after release from custody. And because the commitment power at issue in Comstock is concerned with responsible release of the person and whether or not the federal government can essentially release a clear and present danger, once that person's been released, the basis for that power becomes very attenuated. However, in contrast, the registration requirement here is one that basically assumes release into the community and says it was responsible to release them, but because they don't have the mental illness that renders them highly sexually dangerous. But nonetheless, as a class, persons who have committed sex offenses have a sufficient likelihood of recidivism that it's part of that responsible release to make sure that the community is aware of their presence. This is, in SORNA, Congress had imposed that burden not only on sex offenders, but also on federal releasing officials who have to notify destination communities.
Let's go back to the Commerce Clause, because you argue that it's necessary to track their intrastate travel, or otherwise the whole scheme of SORNA falls apart. It seems to me that can't be true, because you don't prosecute the state convictors who don't register intrastate. I mean, the vast majority of people who are convicted are state offenders, yet they're not tracked under SORNA, they're not convicted under SORNA for failing to register intrastate. So where does that put you under the Commerce Clause?
I've got a couple of responses to that. First, it's never been the test that the specific regulation has to be strictly necessary or else the scheme would fall apart. I mean, going back to McCulloch, the Supreme Court has recognized that as long as Congress is regulating towards a valid end, the question is whether Congress could rationally conclude that this was a useful or a way to achieve to beneficially exercise that powers. Secondly, Congress could reasonably focus its federal prosecutorial resources on persons whose conduct most directly implicates that scheme, who have traveled interstate, or on federal sex offenders for some of the reasons that I mentioned earlier. Federal sex offenders would typically have been under federal supervision, as the Supreme Court recognized.
Well, let's cut to the chase. Does Congress have the authority under the Commerce Clause to punish intrastate people who are convicted under state law for failure to register intrastate?
Yes, and that's what yes, that's and part of our broader argument. It hasn't acted to that full extent here. And it, one additional reason that it would do so is by failing to exercise its full authority under one source of constitutional legislative power, it's bringing the resulting regulation within another source of power and paying respect to the finite nature of legislative authority.
Was this defendant convicted under prong one or prong two? Was this this defendant convicted under for his felony violation or because of interstate travel?
He was charged under the federal offender provision of the sworn as criminal sanction.
So why are we even looking to the interstate aspect of it? Why don't we look simply to the felony? Because that's what he was charged with. That was what he's convicted of, even in the conviction that's before us today, much less his earlier conviction. Why are we talking about interstate travel as it relates to this case?
Because it's open to the government to defend a conviction under alternative reasons.
Well, but when Congress clearly chose two alternatives, one of which was interstate travel, and you're now trying to defend the other provision on the basis of an even broader construction of the Commerce Clause, I think you run the danger of running into the Morrison case.
I think this case is quite distinguishable from Morrison and from Lopez because we're not attempting to regulate non-economic criminal conduct based on its aggregate effect on the national economy. We're not saying that failure to register...
Registration of a sex offender is not very economic. I don't understand what you're saying.
I agree. We're not saying that it is economic
Mr.
conduct.
Mr. Campbell, are you aware that in Lopez the court pointed out that that provision did not regulate the channels of commerce? And in Morrison, the channels of commerce argument wasn't even mentioned.
Correct, and that's the distinction we're making between our Commerce Clause argument here and the Commerce Clause argument rejected in Lopez and Morrison, that we're not arguing
I want to get back to this. If he's convicted under the fact that his felony, federal felony conviction, and he was not convicted on the basis of any interstate commerce violation, how is interstate commerce even in this case, and how are the and if he's convicted under the Military Act,
yes.
How are the necessary and proper clause applicable to interstate commerce to determine this case?
Yes, Judge, I understand your question. This is not a sufficiency challenge to the whether the evidence was sufficient to convict him as charged. This is a challenge to Congress's legislative authority. And if an enactment as narrowed by an as-applied challenge falls within two scopes of congressional authority, it's open to the government to defend it on both reasons. That's something the government has done multiple times in the past, and the Fifth Circuit has in the past upheld.
No, you can't just, as I understand the cases, you can't just roam the entire United States Constitution finding some authority for what you did if it is not the enumerated power that you're attempting to enforce. And here it's not the interstate commerce clause you're trying to enforce, as far as this conviction is concerned. It's the military law.
Well, aren't you really arguing that SORNA is a comprehensive scheme? Its basic purpose is to prevent sex offenders from crossing state lines and getting away, and that it would undercut that whole scheme if you didn't allow the federal government to prosecute federal offenders whenever they move, because they could move and set up a false, clean record for themselves somewhere else in a state and then elope across state lines. Now, the question would be, is it necessary and proper to the regulation of that scheme that you have that? And I thought it was reasonably adapted. Maybe some other people would have some different
I see my time has expired. May I respond, Chief Judge Jones?
I don't think it's a question, but you may make a brief response.
My brief response is that yes, and that in Whaley and the other cases, you're seeing the courts recognize that in rejecting a defendant's overbreadth challenge to the Title 42 requirements. Those defendants traveled in interstate commerce but claimed that the Title 42 requirement was overbroad because it applied without proof of that. That the courts rejected that. And yes, we think the court in Whaley did the same thing, and that's our alternative argument under the Commerce Clause. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Ms. Fuentes?
Very briefly, Your Honor, in response to the government's contentions, and just to clarify, I'm just trying to, with respect to the federal prong, the federal offender prong of the statute, I'm just trying to make it clear that this is a very narrow case. Not that necessarily.
Okay, I want to ask you about that because your brief says, it doesn't say this is a very narrow as applied case. It says, Kibitow contends that Congress lacked constitutional authority to enact the SORNA provisions, period. Summary of argument, Kibitow's conviction for failure to study must be reversed because he was convicted under an unconstitutional statute. You're saying the statute's unconstitutional, not just as applied to Kibitow.
Well, I've said in other places in the brief that it's an as-applied challenge. The government agrees that it's an as-applied challenge. I have not made a facial challenge.
I agree that you made that today, but, I mean, your argument is that this statute's unconstitutional, and that's the argument that you made to the district court.
In prior filings, we have made as-applied challenges, and I guess when anyone speaks in a brief, court opinions, you don't say every detail to everything you say. That's why we have some of the broad Commerce Clause language in Whaley and in the other cases, because they're not always cabined every time you say something. But this is an as-applied challenge, and I don't think there's any dispute on that. And I can go back to the district court and look at the allegations that were made that say we're challenging this as it applies to Mr. Kibitow. But with
respect, what is the value of this as an en banc case? Why did you bring an action en banc?
Because
it's
Mr. Kibitow,
Mr. Kibitow.
Because Mr. Kibitow has been unconstitutionally convicted. He's been unconstitutionally convicted under the application of this statute. And the court has affirmed that, and he is trying to appeal further. But I wanted to make clear it is a narrow challenge. And I don't want to be arguing that the federal government has the power to apply SORNA to anyone because they were once in the military. But I just want to make the point that the court doesn't have to go that far.
Yeah, you were just saying that that's more consistent with, but that's a better argument,
yes,
under Comstock.
Yes, and it's because it's a harder argument to make. I mean, if you look at Comstock, the example that I like from Comstock, from the main opinion, is the court says, consider this analogy. Let's say somebody was in federal custody, and he has a terrible communicable disease, and he's about to be released. Would anybody really say that the federal government has to let him go because his sentence is up? And so that was the analogy the court drew to the civil commitment statute. Under that kind of an analogy, once we've got our hooks in you, if the reason is important enough, we can hold on to you. So the argument could be made that that would apply to all federal offenders. But you don't have to go that far in this case, because Mr. Kibitow was 10 years away, now more than 10 years away.
But you did not contest their...
Please let her finish her answer. I've never
heard... I was just going to say, he's 10 years away from his federal conviction. He's not on supervised release. He's a citizen of the state, and he doesn't travel too much. He's been in Texas since 1999, and he's moved from city to city on occasion. And by and large, he keeps up his federal registration. But in this incident, he didn't. And so the federal power, as applied to him, is unconstitutional in this case.
And my question is, you don't contest they have the federal power to make him register. The government has the federal power to make him register.
That's correct.
So why do they not have the power to enforce that requirement with criminal sanctions?
They do have that power if he crosses state lines, because the way that the cases have been decided is that we can make you register so that if you cross state lines, we can punish you. Now, that is the Commerce Clause aspect, not the federal.
Well, that wouldn't be true if he had no obligation to register. And if he
And if he's not convicted under a statute involving the Interstate Commerce Commission, it's difficult to see how he's required to register under SORNA.
Well, I guess under the broad holding in Whaley, everybody's required to register.
Whalen was not a military conviction.
Well, then I
And that's the crux here. I mean, it's the military conviction, and it's in the military's interest in having him register 6 years after he has left the Army. Now, maybe the federal government has a complete right to make him register. I don't know about that. I'm just saying that the interest that we're talking about and the necessary and proper powers we're talking about relate to the military and their interest.
I agree, Your Honor. Well, and I also agree that in this case, it really is going too far to look at the Commerce Clause aspect because he was not charged with interstate travel.
Let me make sure I understand your answer to the question Judge Jolly was crystallizing. I think I hear you saying you acknowledge or admit that the government could require Kevin O to register. Is that what you said?
Under Whaley, yes.
Right.
Whaley says everybody can be required to register.
All right. And his follow-up question, or a follow-up question was asked by Judge Owen, was then why could not the government enforce his failure to do so with criminal sanctions? I'm not going to the Commerce Clause issues. I'm strictly on the federal nature of the conviction, well, which you have conceded that he had a requirement to register. Then why are you saying that it was unconstitutional to enforce what you acknowledge that he had a requirement to register?
Well, the power to the requirement for registration is valid under the Commerce Clause only. That's why. It's not valid under the federal offender prong. I see my time is up.
All right. Thank you, ma'am. At this time, I would apologize.